listening to Civic from the San Francisco Public Press. On this edition, we'll hear about women who fought the enslavement of women and girls in San Francisco's Chinatown in the late 1800s.
This was an extremely hostile time towards the Chinese, and particularly towards Chinese women. And these white middle-class church women were defying their husbands, were defying the ministers of the church who didn't really like this project very much, and going ahead. The remarkable thing I learned was that there is now a diaspora of Chinese-American families across the country whose grandmothers came through this house.
I'm Laura Wenis, and this is Civic. If I told you to picture Chinatown toward the end of the 1800s, your mind might not immediately conjure up images of oppression, racism, and violence. But this was an era of rampant discrimination against Chinese workers. It was also a time when public officials turned a blind eye and sometimes even enabled a slave trade. Chinese women and girls were arriving by the boatload and immediately being forced into work as prostitutes or into indentured servitude. And while those in power did nothing about the practice, a group of women took it upon themselves to try and rescue victims. Many of them were taken to a safe house and a kind of school called the Cameron House, which still stands today. This is the world journalist Julia Flynn Seiler investigates in her book, The White Devil's Daughters, The Women Who Fought Slavery in San Francisco's Chinatown. Earlier this year, I interviewed Julia about the book and the research that led her to it. We also took a trip to Chinatown to visit the Cameron House itself.
So we're on Stockton Street, and we're looking down towards the bay, and we're about to turn on Sacramento and walk up the hill about a block or two. And we're right on the edge of Chinatown. Okay, let's keep going.
Can you talk a little bit about the change between the neighborhood we just left and where we're going now?
Sure. So we're just walked from Union Square, the Union Square area, and we passed through a little portion of Nob Hill, went past the Ritz-Carlton Hotel, and now we're taking a left onto Sacramento Street, the 900 block. I mean, back in the middle of the 19th century, Sacramento Street was the heart of Chinatown. Not what we now call Grant Avenue. It was then called DuPont Avenue. But Sacramento Street, you see photographs from that period of time, and there are all these little shops up and down here.
So the story that I've told begins in the 1870s in San Francisco, and then it runs until about the 1930s.
Paint a picture for me of what San Francisco was like at this time for Chinese immigrants, because we're talking here about Chinatown and what happened in Chinatown. And these are people who are coming into a country that is pretty directly hostile toward Chinese immigrants. What world were they coming into as they arrived?
They were coming into a very violent world in which there was a great deal of antagonism and also legal harassment of them. Many Chinese men had come to the West Coast to help build the railroads and mine for gold and build the state. And then once the gold rush was ended, those Chinese men often ended up coming back to San Francisco, which was the capital of Chinese America at that time. It was the biggest city in the United States for Chinese immigrants. And in Chinatown itself was roughly, at that point, an 8-square block area, kind of at the heart of the city. And it was highly concentrated. There were something like 12,000 people living in Chinatown at that point. Almost all of them were men. And it was so crowded that, for example, men would take turns sleeping in the same bunk. So you'd have a man sleeping for 8 hours, then another man for another 8 hours, another man for another 8 hours. And as I mentioned, there were a number of legal actions taken by the state and by the country to essentially harass the Chinese. There were ordinances that regulated the way that produce was carried. There were ordinances stating that Chinese men had to have their queues cut if they ended up in jail. And that, of course, was a very dramatic move on the part of the white world towards the Chinese because for them, for the Chinese men, those queues were representative of their loyalty to the home that they planned to return to.
And to be clear about the ordinances about how produce is carried, that meant that people couldn't carry produce on poles across their shoulders, right? Which is a practice that was common in Chinatown.
Yes, that's exactly right. And they were essentially just in different ways to harass the Chinese.
And very targeted ways. I mean, it just strikes me how specific to Chinese immigrants these ordinances were.
Absolutely. And notably, there was the passage of what was known as the Page Act, which was targeted at Chinese women, the presumption being that Chinese women who came into the United States were coming as prostitutes. And so it was an effort to stop the number of Chinese women coming in. There, in fact, was a Supreme Court case involving that. It's colloquially known as the case of the 22 lewd women. So it was a very, basically, it was a very, very hostile environment. In the 1870s, there was a shocking instance of violence against the Chinese in Los Angeles, where 18 Chinese men were killed. 15 of those men were lynched.
Wow.
Yes.
And this is also in a period preceding what became, you know, you might call this a stain on American history of immigration law, the Chinese Exclusion Act.
Yes, that was passed in 1882. It was an act that was driven by fears that immigrants were going to be taking jobs from white American citizens. And so it dramatically limited the number of Chinese people by race who could enter the United States.
And putting those fears in context, I mean, Chinese laborers had contributed enormously to the construction, for example, of the Transcontinental Railroad and had been laboring in the United States for a long time, but often for less money than other races.
Yes.
And so on one hand, there was a fear of they'll take our jobs, but on the other hand, there was not a willingness to pay them equally. And then all these exclusionary laws.
Yes, historians only now are starting to really recognize the contribution that Chinese laborers made to the construction of the West. It's the 150th anniversary of the Transcontinental Railroad this year, and there's been a big project headed out of Stanford to finally try to recognize some of those railroad workers.
So let's talk about the world that women are coming into here, specifically Chinese women. In the 1870s, Chinatown was, as you've already mentioned, really kind of a bachelor society. There were many, many men and not that many women. Census takers from 1870 recorded that there was about one Chinese woman for every 10 Chinese men. And the census takers also counted that nearly three-quarters of those women were prostitutes. This is according to the official record. Do you know how accurate that actually was?
Well, we can't tell how accurate it was. Remember, prostitution was not illegal during that time, and academics assume that is roughly accurate because, for one thing, that's really the only metric we have at that point in time. It is also a reflection of the opportunities available to Chinese women. And one thing to remember is that the women who were there and who were involved in the sex trade, either as brothel operators or as prostitutes, some number, we don't know how many, but some number of those women were forced into prostitution or were sex slaves. So the world that women came into, Chinese women came into in Chinatown was a violent one, extremely hostile one from the white world, and it was often a short-lived one for them. Many of the women who were involved in the sex trade did not live very long. They lived perhaps 4 to 5 years, a result of disease or abuse or some other reasons. And because their bodies would not be shipped back to China, sometimes they were left to die on the streets.
Yeah, I wanted to get into a little bit of the details about what was actually happening mm-hmm. to these trafficked women. You read about women and young girls, really, like 11-year-old girls. I don't know if maybe even younger, but that's one number that stood out to me in one of the stories that you capture. But these are women and young girls being forced into prostitution, sometimes after being sold by their families because of oppressive poverty. And they're facing these humiliating examinations by their sellers and their buyers, repeated rape, what I was reading as psychological manipulation by their captors. And then they're forced to sign these contracts with their thumbprints, even if they're not literate. They're signing these contracts that say they're willingly entering into prostitution for a number of years, and after that, they're their own masters. But like you just said, sometimes they don't even live as long as the end of these contracts. So can you tell me a little bit more about the realities that women and girls were really facing here when we say forced into prostitution? What was it that they were actually facing?
Well, imagine what the structures were like that they were operating in. At the lower end, there were cribs, and these cribs were tiny little segmented areas. Often the bed areas would be divided by sheets. And really, as you point out, the girls, they were often girls, were servicing 10, 20 men a night. And this was going on for years. And because of the racism of the time, Chinese were not allowed to be treated at most hospitals in the city. So when there was disease, when there was abuse, they had very few options for finding treatment or care. It was a brutal, brutal and very short existence for these mostly girls.
Yeah, one story that stood out to me is you write about a woman being approached for donations for victims of the slave trade who said she would give nothing for such, quote, depraved women and wouldn't be sorry if all of them were burned.
It was shocking, some of the things that I found in the course of my research, and that was one of the most shocking things.
Ultimately, though, this book is about the women who then organized to try and intercede.
Yes. So this is what I consider to be a actually inspiring book about a group of women who saw this social injustice, who saw this wrong, and tried to do something about it.
How did they connect with these women? There's a story that comes through at the beginning of your book about a girl who is escaping, who is fleeing her captors. And my understanding is that some girls and women did escape and flee to these safe houses, which had developed a reputation. But there were also active rescues. Can you describe how that worked?
Sure. An active rescue, mean. So the typical rescue would involve a staff member of the home, perhaps a staff member plus another staff member who could translate into the Chinese of the language that was spoken by the vulnerable woman. And they would go to the brothel, or they would go to wherever the young woman was being held. And sometimes they would bash down doors. Sometimes they would scramble over skylights and drop down into the building. Sometimes they were accompanied by police officers. Sometimes they were accompanied by men known as specials. And these were essentially kind of detectives. And the detectives might be carrying, truncheons or some sort of weapons to help batter down doors. And so they occasionally would use kind of extra legal methods to find the vulnerable women and take them out of their situation.
So this relationship with law enforcement strikes me as really interesting and sort of variable throughout the different parts of the story that are woven together in the book, and maybe also just through the eras. But, you know, on one hand, you have these descriptions of boatloads of Chinese women arriving to be trafficked into the sex trade, and then law enforcement basically corralling them and keeping the crowds away, but also making sure that they got to ultimately their traffickers mm-hmm. and where they were intended to go by their traffickers. And then on the other hand, There's stories of active rescues that the police are a part of and, you know, coming in as the sort of muscle enforcing these rescues. So what was that relationship like between these missionary women and law enforcement?
You describe it perfectly, which is in the very early days, the 1860s and 1870s, there are indications that the police were being bribed, at least some police were being bribed to escort the women up to the brothels. So they had their hands in the till of the trafficking, for sure. And there are indications that that went on into the 20th century with some involvement by law enforcement in aiding the traffickers. However, there are also stories of members of the police force who supported the workers at the home in fighting essentially the sex trade, fighting sexual slavery. One example of that is a man named Jack Mannion, who in the 1920s and 1930s headed up the Chinatown squad for the San Francisco Police Department. And he became friends with the woman who was the superintendent of the home, and he was very actively involved in supporting her work.
Julia was part of a panel discussion at Cameron House this fall, hosted and recorded by the Chinese Historical Society of America. The Reverend Harry Chuck, a Chinatown civil rights leader, shared his memories of Sergeant Jack Mannion, who headed a notorious police force known as the Chinatown Squad.
Growing up in Chinatown, instead of having uniformed policemen, we had the Chinatown Squad. And some of you may remember that, they wore suits. And every cop wanted to be on the Chinatown Squad. And I've seen it. They can walk into a store, look at something and say, isn't that nice? And the guy says, I'll wrap it up for you. But also Sergeant Mannion, good cop. He was a good cop. But he was a tough one. And if the kids were misbehaving and parents were having problems with the kids, he would take them down to the Hall of Justice, get on the elevator, stop the elevator halfway between floors, make the kid pull his pants down, and took out the belt, his belt, and he would thrash him, on the butt. And the only reason why I know this is because one of my former colleagues, Bert Tom, used to get thrashed all the time. we would see Sergeant Mannion coming down the street. He said, Mannion, Mannion, and everybody split. So.
Reverend Chuck grew up to become a Chinatown housing activist. He served as a member of the San Francisco Housing Commission and later became executive director of Cameron House. He retired from that post in 2001. You've been listening to Civic from the San Francisco Public Press.
The San Francisco Public Press and KSFP rely on support from readers and listeners like you. That's why we're excited to participate in Newsmatch, a national collaboration of journalism funders. Newsmatch will double donations from individuals to the public press through the end of the year. Your pledge will support independent, diverse local perspectives and investigative reporting. Visit sfpublicpress.org/donate.
This is KSFP LP, San Francisco.
Welcome back to Civic. Let's get back to the story of how a group of women took on sex trafficking and slavery in Chinatown around the turn of the 20th century.
I want to read here an excerpt that you have in the book from the Daily Examiner at the time, which ran an editorial on its front page implying that the police, and specifically the police captain in charge of the operation, had been bribed to keep women safe from the crowds and make sure that they were delivered to Chinatown. So that's the other thing that I found sort of curious about law enforcement, going back to sort of the beginning of this era, is that not only was this happening, but it was totally out in the open and obvious. I mean, the Examiner is writing a front page editorial. And this just sort of went on. Was there kind of a sea change at some point?
Well, absolutely. San Francisco was such a wild town. I mean, this is only 20 years after the Gold Rush, in which essentially the city had exploded in terms of population. And again, prostitution was not illegal. And the Barbary Coast, which was the vice district adjacent to Chinatown, was exploding. It was a source of enormous revenue and attraction for the city. Visitors would come to visit the Barbary Coast and its brothels and its gambling dens and so forth and so on, most famous for sailors being shanghaied from there and shipped unknowingly on, or transported unknowingly onto ships so that they would be forced into labor. So it was a pretty wild town, and almost anything went. And one thing that's so fascinating to me is the way the newspapers got in there. And they were pointing out the corruption. And that was a great source of pleasure for me to kind of follow the 19th century newspapers, early 20th centuries, and how they covered this issue, because they were feisty and they had undercover reporters and they were going for it.
Were you able to trace any impact of that reporting?
Absolutely. So one example is in right at the turn of the century, 1901, there was an expose in one of the papers, and that expose led to a series of hearings amongst state legislators on the issue of vice in Chinatown. And specifically, there were hearings having to do with the so-called slave girl traffic, and what we would call it today, of course, is human trafficking and sex slavery. And the girls and the young women of the house that I write about, 920 Sacramento Street, testified behind closed doors in front of those legislators. And the legislators, in turn, ended up passing one of the first anti-trafficking measures in the state. So that is why I call what was going on there and really a fight against slavery. Because the women who were involved with this project weren't just trying to offer refuge, they were also trying to stop this trade.
There are so many layers to what they were actually doing and what motivated them. I mean, we can't know what the actual motivation of any individual human being is, but just from the records and the narratives and the accounts that you've found, it sounds like there are just different aspects to this. There's the religious, of course, like you mentioned, the opportunity to convert people, which, you know, the language used is sometimes pretty condescending, convert the heathens,
absolutely,
you know, save their souls. But then there's also, it seems like, a genuine just element of empathy, which was sorely lacking at the time, you know, talking about the woman who says, "I hope they all burn." And being a woman at that time, a white woman, a religious woman, and saying, "No, actually, we're going to provide housing and we want to make sure that they have better lives." Can you talk a little bit more about what moved these women to do this, and what to them what success looked like to them?
I do think radical empathy is a theme that runs through the book and runs through the motivations of a number of the characters that we meet in the book. And as we were discussing earlier, you know, this was an extremely hostile time towards the Chinese, and particularly towards Chinese women. And these white middle-class church women were defying their husbands, were defying the ministers of the church who didn't really like this project very much, and going ahead. And I think that one of their reasons for doing this was because they saw something that was so egregious. Early on, one of their first reports that they wrote about the project, they described it as woman's work for women. It was, in a sense, a feminist project from the very beginning. And to really understand that, you have to look at what their roles were in that Victorian era in the 1870s. I mean, what opportunities did they have to exercise power, to try to make change? And the way that they could do that, they didn't have the vote, they didn't have very much financial power, but they, within the kind of the worldview at that point of what women could do, they could do charitable projects. They could work within the home to effect change. So in a sense, this is brilliant. Okay, we're going to start our own home, and we will bring about change within that home. I think it's pretty clever. And, of course, it was the beginnings, it was the earliest seeds of what we now know as the progressive movement.
Coming up on the next episode of Civic, we'll go inside the Cameron House and learn more about the women who fought the sex trafficking of women and girls.
What bound them together was that they were church women and they saw social injustice and they wanted to try to make a change. And so they set up a safe house on the edge of Chinatown, originally in an apartment, and then they kind of raised enough money to buy a home on Sacramento Street.
So now we're standing on the steps here. Has much changed about the structure of the building since, you know, women and girls passed through here trying to escape slavery?
No, almost nothing has changed. There was a earthquake retrofitting in the 70s, but still the main portion of the building, the exterior and even the interior, is very much the same. The doors, the big, heavy wooden doors with the metal grating, those date back 100 years. They didn't change. So I think that's one of the great treasures of this building. And it kind of in itself encapsulates the this very vivid history of San Francisco.
That's on our next edition. I'm Laura Wenis, and you've been listening to Civic.
Civic is a production of the San Francisco Public Press, sfpublicpress.org. Your host is Laura Wenis, producer and contributor, Mel Baker. The publisher of the San Francisco Public Press is Lila LaHood. Executive Director, Michael Stoll. Interim Managing Editor, Noah Arroyo. Director of Membership and Community, Daphne Magnawa. Civic is aired on KSFP LP, San Francisco, a low-power FM radio station at 102.5 FM. Thanks for listening.